Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to From the Rookery End, a podcast about Watford Football Club, brought to you by The Athletic. My name is John. With me, after Watford drew 0-0 away at the City Ground against Nottingham Forest, is Colin.
Good evening.
And Michael.
Hello.
There'll be a podcast we do sort of the end of May, mid-end of May. It'll be highlights of the year. We'll talk about lots of games. Don't think we'll be talking about this one. What do you reckon, Colin?
No, we won't be. Almost certainly, it will be forgotten and put in beyond the memory banks where it can no longer be retrieved from the hard disk. A poor, rather dull, rather uninteresting game with almost no incident apart from possible sending off for Chalabar for a second yellow card, which wasn't given. So he escaped one there, although he is not going to play on Saturday because he's reached the magic five yellow cards already. So,
Faye Hollabas of him.
That was the about the only thing that stood out for me. But I'd just like to say that the last time we played Forest, which was in our promotion season, it was also a midweek evening game. And I took Florence, who was then, I guess, 12 or 13, and it was her first ever evening away game. I picked her up from school. We drove like all the way to Nottingham, almost didn't make it because of the traffic, got there and watched a game that couldn't be more of a contrast than tonight's rather dull fare. We watched a 3-1 win. Matthew Connolly, who was a loanee, some people will remember him, he was a loanee from Cardiff that the Pozzos had brought in. He made this kind of startling, he was a centre-back or a left-back, and he made this startling run from one end of the pitch in our area all the way up to the other end of the pitch, shot. It hit the keeper. It came down to Igalo, and Igalo pushed it back to Connolly, who scored. And we went 2-0 up, I think, and then it was 2-1, and then Abdi scored the most beautiful goal. You should watch it on YouTube. It's just like a pass. It's like so. It's full of grace and skill, and just he's so relaxed. He just sort of side foots it into the goal for the third goal. And we were behind that goal second half. We were screaming. It was our promotion year. And it was a very exciting game, and then we drove home full of elation. And I'm rather
the complete opposite of today.
Yeah, exactly.
Mike, this is our waveform is the thing that people have been discussing, and we had a couple of mentions of it on the WhatsApp group. Can you put your finger on it? Do you think it's more of a mentality thing? Do you think it's more the fact that we are the big dogs and teams are having us at theirs and don't want to be embarrassed at home and lose their home form? What is it, do you think? Can you put your finger on it?
I can't really put my finger on it, no. I mean, we have scored goals. I mean, the thing that stands out is, and I think we'd be remiss of us not to mention this stat right at the start, is that's now 8 away games and 3 goals, which is... That's abnormal by anyone's standards. Even if you were bottom of the league, I think you'd probably expect to score more than 3 goals in an 8-game period. Contrast that with, we also have to look at it in context of where we are in the league, which is joint second, 1 point off top. So in the wider scheme of things, things are obviously going all right, aren't they? And Geordie tonight on WhatsApp was making an impassioned defence of where we're at, and it's hard to argue with the where we are in the league, isn't it? If we're planning to get back into the Premier League, then we are there or thereabouts where we need to be. But yeah, your question is I'm not answering your question because I haven't got an answer. It's at home we've been. I hesitate to say we've been magnificent because I think the performances we've had a little bit of luck here and there. Been far from comprehensive, far from convincing at home with Saturday's victory over Preston North End accepted. But the results have been good, and the goals have gone in a little bit, haven't they? And so, yeah, it's just how do you odds a team that scored 4 in one game on Saturday and scored three in what, a quarter of the season, in eight games away from home.
The only thing I can sort of put down to is we've done two midweek podcasts in a row where we've sort of said, God, Watford aren't as good. And that's the fact that we are playing a lot of football very, very quickly, Colin. Do you think is it catching up on this or on this squad? Not because it's a quality squad, we know that's true, but in terms of the depth of this squad at the moment?
I don't think it's catching up, but I do think there's an issue, which is, and I listened to one of the women football players who plays for England, and I think maybe Chelsea, and she was saying when you play a lot of games in a row, the toughest day of your week is what she called match day plus two. So you play a match on the Saturday, match day plus one is Sunday, match day plus two is the Monday. And that's the day that you really feel the fatigue. That's the day where you really need to rest and recover. Now, if you're playing every 3 or 4 days, match day plus two is also match day minus one for the next game. Mm. And on that day, she was really clear. She said, in the day before a game, that's when you do your most intense training because you're setting yourself up for the intensity, your intensity in the game. So you get the squad players to play as your opposition. You put your 11 on the training pitch and you play with real intensity. Now, if that is also match day plus two, that's when all the players are feeling fatigued. So coaches will be worried about being too intense. And I thought it really showed tonight because Forest really looked there for the taking. They didn't press us. They looked nervous. They didn't seem all that confident. They sat in their own half. They were happy to soak up pressure at home against us. But what we didn't have was that extra 10% of intensity where we could drive players into the box. We could bring those fullbacks up to support the front players and create chance after chance. We had total control of the game. In fact, it was almost too easy. And I wonder whether that is because after only 3 days rest, they haven't had a chance to regain that intensity for a match, or whether they're being slightly protective of their bodies because they can feel that fatigue starting to build up. Or whether it could just have been that they were so confident, Watford, because Forrest basically just gave them the ball and said, off you go, lads, play. We're going to sit deep and you have to break us down. And I think Watford played a little bit like, well, if we keep playing like this, we're going to score at some point. And then it just didn't happen. And in the second half, they kind of realised that, Forrest, and they came out and they did play with more intensity and they actually threatened us. So I think it's a combination probably of all those things. Mentally, it's tough to play a game, try to recover physically, then try to go again 3 days later and then play another match with the right mental attitude, with the right physical strength. I think it is hard. We've got good players in our squad. We had a strong bench. Maybe if we can settle on a good system and the whole squad knows what the system is, then maybe you can rotate a little bit more and give some players a rest and freshen the 11 up with players who haven't played 3 days before, who can bring that sort of intensity. But it seemed to me, particularly in the first half, that Ivic had told Ngakia and Firmino not to get up, to stay basically, to go to the halfway line and stop. In the second half, he sent them forward a bit more. But actually, if he just had that little in-game insight and thought, look at Forest, they're sitting so deep. They're begging us to score. I think Tommy Mooney said it in the commentary. Forest looked like they're just waiting for Watford to score. And if he'd seen that and said to the two fullbacks, this is the moment after 10, 15 minutes, just go and push the wide players narrower towards Deeney, get more men in the box, push Garner up or push Queener into the middle and just create some chances and score a goal, because one goal was always going to win that game, I felt, and we weren't able to get it.
I thought we looked more encouraging in the first half than we did this time last week in that game that I was so disappointed at Bristol City. I thought at least there was a bit of industry and a bit of dynamism and a bit of movement in that final third. It wasn't clicking, but at least they were trying to make things happen. They were playing the balls and moving, ducking inside, trying to get it out wide. And I think the delivery again was a big problem tonight. And it didn't click early on, but you did get the sense that, right, we are going to get in behind. Saar was buzzing around a little bit. Queener was busy again, wasn't he? And I thought he was good. João Pedro is obviously... you know, the touch he has and the skill he has is only ever going to take a flash from him to get through. Thought Troy Deeney looked okay again. So, but it just didn't happen. And ultimately, we didn't lay a glove on them, really, did we? The only chance was the late Deeney chance in the second half. And And I take on board what you're saying, Colin, about the fatigue and quoting a professional footballer. Obviously, I'm not going to argue with that. But also, you think about how buoyant we were on Saturday evening and how effusive we were about the performance and how we said, right, we hope this is a springboard. And if a team is going to sort of beat fatigue, you would have thought it would be off the back of a thumping 4-1 home win against a team struggling for points who are sitting off. And it's just whether it has just become, whether it could be instructions from Vladimir Ivic away from home. You know, he may well be in cahoots with Jace. We'll win our home games and we'll draw our away games. And they could have made a pact between them, and they're going to, God damn it, they're going to stick to it.
I do like the fact that already on our WhatsApp group, Jason has already said, he said, win your home games, draw your away games, blah, blah, blah. You know, I mean, even he knows he's the stuck record.
I mean, we sort of had, not arguments, but debates among ourselves on the WhatsApp group, DCW suggesting that he'd prefer to see a 4-3 defeat instead of another 0-0. And I understand 100% where he's coming from, and I'm sure the watching public do it as well. But also, you know, a draw is a point. And, you know, I made the analogy, which I was quite pleased of, actually. One of my, it's not like a, we're like a heavyweight championship boxer clinching our way to a points decision. And you mentioned at the start there, John, we would talk about individual games. We certainly won't talk about this one. But if we win the league by a point, then this has been a good result, hasn't it? So
I think it's a bit different in the Championship. I was talking this over with Oliver Wicken. We were having a chat on the phone. And he was saying one of the things he was enjoying about being in the Championship was the difference in emphasis on each game. We all know that, you know, when you play in the Premier League, as we have done for the last five seasons, it becomes almost unbearable, the pressure on every single game. You know, you've got to get a point from this game. You've lost your last three. You've got to find a win from somewhere. Every single game becomes this kind of epic moment in the season. We lost our first four games last season. Manager went, panic stations, you know, how are we going to get out of it? You look at Sheffield United this season, 1 point from nine games, panic, you know, they're not going to panic, but they're going to find it very, very hard to stay up with that kind of start. In the Championship, you don't have to think about individual games in quite the same way. Or this was the point Ollie was making. He was saying, you know, you can take four or five games and say, well, we're playing five games this month, or we're playing three games in the next 10 days or whatever. And you can take those games as a kind of, as a trio of games and think, okay, well, it would be really good if we could get 7 points from those games. So that's a boring nil-all draw. If we beat Cardiff, then we're still ahead of the curve, if you like. And when he said that, it kind of made sense to me, also relaxed me somewhat, because I was still slightly in Premier League mode, like every game, you know, we've got to get something from this game. It is very, very different, the Championship. And I think we're all having to adjust in some way and not quite sure. I wasn't quite sure how to respond to that game, but I didn't know whether I should be cross or frustrated, or whether I should be happy with a point, or, oh, well, that's just another point in the bag. Let's move on to Saturday, beat Cardiff. That'll be 4 points from the two games. You know, hurrah, let's move on. We've got another 12 million games before Boxing Day. So it's kind of weird, isn't it? It's very hard to know quite how to react. Obviously, you know how to react to a 4-1 thumping at home. But when it's a nil or draw, it's hard to know.
There's no point pretending it's anything other than dull as dishwater. It's absolutely, you know, Tommy Mooney and John Marks on commentary were joking about the viewers or listeners that were left that hadn't switched over to I'm a Celebrity. So, you know,
it was on in the background, Mark. It was on in the background.
there's no sugar. In fact, that might be a decent Bush Tucker trial. Let's see if you can sit through a Watford away game and get 10 stars for your campmates. But, you know, there's no sugarcoating it. But by the same token, if Watford draw, nil-nil draw their way away from home to promotion, no one, and I do mean no one, will care. We'll be back in the Premier League and we'll have the other stresses to worry about that Colin just talked about. So, and yeah, I think Colin's right. It's an odd situation, exacerbated, of course. And you know, this is the week finally that we're finally seeing supporters back in. But we're not there. No one is there to vent their frustration or to have a pint or a pie or to laugh at that Amiobi cross-come shot or whatever it was.
was funny.
It was quite extraordinary, wasn't it? I thought Tommy Mooney and John Marks were absolutely going to lose it at one point with the. But that was the nature of the game. That was the most entertaining bit of it. But no one get you don't get that visceral that, you know, everything that Colin explained, going up there with Flo, the mad rush, the you're too hot because your coat's on and you've had to rush to get to the game. You stay too long cheering at the end and then you realise it's 3 o'clock in the morning by the time you get home. All that sort of stuff, all that guff and nonsense that combines to make football what we know it is. We're not getting it. All we're getting is sitting in front of a laptop or a TV screen watching it, and it's with no fans in the ground on TV either. So it's the experience is totally alien to us all, and we're not getting the nutritious bits out of it, which is why those results feel difficult to take, and they are boring. We're old enough and ugly enough to say what it is: boring, dull, attritional football. There was no real attacking flair, no real attacking intent that came to anything. Defensively, we were solid, and it's another point. And that's it. And if that's enough to get us up, then good. But it's a massive, massive gamble. And I really don't think that with a squad like ours, they should be accepting too many performances like that. We've already had too many. You know, Christian Cabaselli was on at the full-time whistle talking to Emma and Rob Page and Helen Ward, who were all excellent, I thought, tonight in helming that coverage. And great insight from both Helen and Rob Page. They continue to get really interesting guests on there. So that's a plus. Cabaselli afterwards was saying, I'm upset and disappointed because we want to get back to the Premier League and that's not how you do it. So at least there is some... and that's not Vladimir Ivic coming out and saying we haven't played well enough. That's the centre-back coming off the pitch and within 45 seconds saying he's disappointed and upset. So at least that's something. But it also tells me, well, why? Why has that performance happened again? You know, there's been 8 pretty average, at best, away performances, haven't they? Mm. They've varied from subpar to roundabout par if on a good day. That, you know, the best has been that, you know, we won away at Derby but through 1 minute of one João Pedro wonder strike. Otherwise that would have been 0-0 as well. So why is it? And you know, are the players good enough? That's a question. Are they good enough to do it regularly? Because we talked about, yes, we're scoring at home, but also the performances haven't exactly been overwhelmingly positive, exciting and confidence inspiring, have they? So are they good enough? There's still a lot of questions, but second in the league, one off the top with a third of the season gone. So if we repeat that for the next two thirds, then, you know, it's going to be an interesting last couple of weeks, and we probably won't be arguing too much. But it'd be fascinating to see, you know, what impact the crowds coming back has. I know, you know, there's been a lot made of it, and I think that the crowds that have been there tonight, they've made a surprising amount of noise, has been the evidence that I've seen and heard. So I think it will be noisy. I think the players will react well to it. But there is obviously a concern that whilst a clean sheet and a point away from home is never to be sniffed at, it's the regularity of these off-key, downbeat, uninspiring, slightly worrying performances away from home, and that there are a lot of questions over that, and why the fact we've been talking for 20-25 minutes. There's perhaps the fatigue thing that Colin says, which I think is sensible. Whether they're managing it, I get that. I think that probably for me feels a bit of a cop out at this time of the season with the squad we've got, which now, by the way, we're going to have to use. Chalabar is now suspended, 5 yellow cards. Cathcart's done his hamstring. Kapu, Sema, and another are going to be out, assuming it's those two that had the COVID issue. So we are going to have to shuffle the packet to a degree on Saturday against Cardiff. But I just think there's enough depth in this squad for us to manage the workload and quite frankly give it a little bit more of a go than that. I mean, when Troy Deeney hit that shot and you saw the ferocity of it from the replay, that, oh my gosh, it was quite shocking. It was like, oh, blimey, he hit that hard, didn't he? Kicked that ball. Yeah. It's like it almost shook everyone out of their sort of slumber, and it shouldn't be like that, should it? It's the, you know, no. the most active, the most exciting, and I use the word advisedly, it was when those couple of rash challenges, when we wondered whether Chalabar was going to get sent off. That was the height, really, of the second half intrigue. And, you know, that's from an entertainment point of view, none out of 10. keeping the season ticking over, 7 out of 10. But are we going to get away with that for much longer? I have my doubts, but you know, we are where we are, and you can't pick holes in the stats, in the data, in the league table, can you?
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
From the Rookery End, a podcast about life following Watford FC.
As we normally do on these midweek podcasts, we catch up with Adam Neventhal, the Watford correspondent for The Athletic. We get to hear about all the things he's been up to and what he's been investigating. Get to hear from Adrian Mariappa in this little section that we recorded earlier at the City Ground while he was on his phone to Mike and I. And of course, we had to discuss a certain person who has been, yet again, a very silly boy. Earlier this week, your focus went back to Mr. Andre Gray. And his, let's say, lack of sense is how I want to say, maybe I'm wrong, about how he is acting as a public figure during these very unfortunate times that we live in with COVID. And he got caught again, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. It was an article that appeared in the Sun newspaper late on Monday night. And it showed a little video image of Andre at what appeared to be sort of like a bar within his house, and then a group of friends with them playing poker in the foreground. And it was clear that there had been a gathering. And within that article, you know, it was very straight up, really. It was the case that Andre Gray had apologised and wholeheartedly, you know, accepted that it was a mistake. And then from my point of view, it was just a matter of then seeing, right, well, what are the next steps in terms of what the club is going to do? And they made it very clear, and this was, you know, via Vladimirovich's press conference as well, when he spoke about his disappointment. The club had said, you know, we're going to keep this private. Basically, I wanted to sort of have a look at how the club potentially would react, even though they'd said that they wanted to keep things in-house. I was able to sort of find out a little bit of detail about how the contracts are structured in terms of disciplinary issues. Get an initial oral warning or then a written warning. And then if there's another second offence, which obviously in Andre Gray's case, this was his second offence because he was censured for holding that party back at the end of June. And it was just trying to work out what situation that the club was going to be in terms of what financial punishment they might give him, or if it was going to be anything more. So, you know, that's all in the article that I've written recently. And obviously, Surrey Police, he lives down in Surrey, they were also notified about the incident, and that led to them looking into the circumstances of it. And, you know, I discovered the fact that they have actually fined him a fixed penalty, which is £200. Now, that obviously doesn't seem a lot of money to a multi-million pound footballer, but, you know, let's be fair in this. You can't just, you know, structure your fines for someone simply because they've got a lot of money. It doesn't work like that. So this is a standard fine that they would give anyone that was found to have committed this sort of offence. Obviously, if there was a larger scale rave that had been organised by Andre Gray, then that would have been where you'd start to get the higher fines, upwards of, you know, £6,000, £7,000, £9,000, £10,000. But that wasn't the case, and officers visited his home, as I understand it, and he was given that fine. So, you know, you've got all the details there, and the article sort of goes into the ins and outs of it. But then you obviously have the fan reaction as well, and the club reaction. Quite rightly, there's disappointment within the club, because the whole image of the club is sort of tainted a little bit when you've got a player not abiding by the rules, and many of the other players seemingly are doing so, especially with the work that the club has done so closely aligned with the Watford General Hospital next door, and, you know, support for NHS workers, the Hornets at Home programme, which is trying to sort of help people that are maybe isolated, maybe have suffered losses and all that sort of stuff. It's just such a shame that, having, you know, committed this initial offence back in June, that he didn't learn his lesson and thought that he could still stay outside of the rules. And I just think it's you know, it's not the most heinous of crimes that he has committed. But at this sort of very, very sensitive time where everyone has made sacrifices, and it's a record going round again. We're talking about exactly the same things with Andre Gray. It's just a real disappointment that he has felt that he could sit outside of these rules. And at the same time, and this is just one other thing, he was also injured in the game against Preston. So I could imagine that he was feeling pretty miserable that evening. And in normal circumstances, and I'm not going to speak for, you know, anyone else, but say if it was me and I was injured and I thought, right, I've missed the first 2 months of the season, I might be facing another 8 weeks on the sideline because I've done my hamstring again. I would think, you know what, I'm pretty beeped off and I want to sort of escape from this and have a few drinks, invite my mates around, and just sort of a bit of escapism. And I can understand that side of things. So there's a mental health sort of side of things to it.
That's the whole point, isn't it? And we don't want to dwell on this too long. But that is the point, that we all want to escape from everything that's going on at the moment.
You're right. That is the point. In normal circumstances, you would do that. But we're not in normal circumstances. And did it before and been told not to do it. So don't do it again. But I think, you know, that's the long and short of it, isn't it?
There's people in a lot less secure situations than Andre Gray who are able to toe the line, to abide by the rules. And it's not just the fact they're rules, it's the fact that the rules are in place. Let's remember why those rules are in place: to protect each other. And that's what it comes down to. It's how you act as a human being. Made my thoughts pretty clear when this happened the first time. My view obviously hasn't changed. You know, I have a son who's at risk. My parents are elderly. We have people very close to us who have lost people. So you have to make your mind up how you act as a person under what are very, very difficult circumstances. But you weigh up the right and the left and you choose which way you go. And I don't want to say any more about it because I've said it all before. And I think everyone's on the same page on it. It's deeply, deeply disappointing.
Well, one now former Watford player who has the values that we want to keep within our football club is Adrian Mariappa. Adam, you got to speak to him this week, his first interview since leaving Watford. Well, you did ask him, didn't you, about that exit. What did you get much?
No, he was prepared to talk about it in a diplomatic way. And as you've alluded to there, that's the sort of expectation that you would have of someone like Adrian Mariappa. You know, he's someone with the club at his heart, and he's not going to be someone that's going to come out and be all guns blazing and sort of do some big expose and say this went wrong, he's an idiot and all that sort of stuff. And he's also not cut from that critical cloth, really. Maybe, you know, down the line he might choose to right some wrongs or say certain things. Maybe he might do that. But he's at the moment trying to build the next chapter of his career. And I think sort of showing that you're sort of someone that shoots from the hip all the time doesn't necessarily endear yourself to future employers. And at the moment, you know, he's just played his first 90 minutes for Bristol City against QPR. Well done to him. They won at QPR. And he's now moving on. That was the case in the interview that I did with him. There were so many other things to talk about with him, in particular, how he dealt with the fact that he wasn't going to have his contract renewed and how he sort of was able to then go, right, okay, I've got to switch my focus to getting another club. And I was actually able to speak to both him and to his fitness instructor, strength and conditioning coach, Matt Springham, who used to work at Watford, who that's where they first got to know each other. And Matt Springham have worked together ever since, prior to every pre-season, just so he's sort of in the right condition just to go back into pre-season. And that sort of speaks of his dedication to his trade. So I was able to sort of find out what he did, you know, that he was training with two other guys that had been released from Reading, one of his former clubs, in between his two spells at Watford. And he was, you know, just the sort of dedicated pro that you would expect, just concentrating on his physical fitness. And that's tied in with his mental health as well. You know, he did admit that it's been hard, but being able to dedicate himself to moving on to the next step and sort of isolating that disappointment away from his day-to-day workings when he could concentrate on fitness and all that sort of stuff was his main thing. So, you know, that was one of the topics that I was able to talk to him about, but there were so many more, of course.
Let's hear a bit of that interview that Adam did with Adrian. I feel bad calling him Maps. I want to call him Maps, and I feel like a friend. But anyway,
Mr. Mariappa.
Mr. Mariappa. And about the exit and other things about his time at Watford FC.
obviously I didn't know my future at that point as regards to, you know, whether I was still going to be at Watford or not. I was, like I said, I was on holiday, and I always knew I was going to come back from holiday. And, you know, even before anyone had gone back to pre-season, I booked in with Matt anyway to do work leading up to pre-season, even though obviously it was a short period of time. But yeah, that was always my plan. And if I didn't go back in pre-season, you know, at Watford or anywhere else, I knew that my plan was to just carry on working and obviously ramp it up. So eventually when I did go in somewhere, I could be as ready as I could. I trust Matt and his work so much. You know, the results I've seen in my personal development coming back to pre-seasons after working with him, and I always feel like I've had a really good edge coming back, feeling in great, you know, physical form, and, you know, in that turn gives you confidence as well. So that was, you know, always my plan. I could have just gone and done it on myself. Working with someone who has that level of expertise as he does, you know, it gives you confidence that, you know, you're doing stuff that's going to benefit, you know, you're going to see real benefit. We were doing 4 sessions a week in person, but he was setting up my whole week. So my rest days, telling me the days I should be doing yoga sessions and, you know, what I should be doing on my rest days and stuff, and just allowed him just to take control of all of it, really.
Would this be the first period of time where you've had to do this?
When I left Crystal Palace and I re-signed at Watford, that was right at the end of the transfer window. That time, because I had international duty, so I played in the Copa America, so that obviously extended, you know, the time that, you know, my season was longer anyway. Obviously, that was a shorter period of time, so I'd had a little bit of time off and then done my own work then. But seeing the difference from doing my own work then to the next few summers of working with Springy, the difference was, you know, it was huge. And this is one of the reasons why, obviously, I love working with Matt, because you can just dial in and focus on the session and what you need to do. You know, when I was very young, you know, I was lucky enough to work with sports psychologists and stuff. And, you know, one of the key things that always stuck with me was, you know, control the controllable. You know, so you can't control COVID, you know, who's going to give you contracts, etc. You know, some of those things you can't control. But, you know, the things you can control is going out, doing the work that's required, making sure you're as ready as you can be. You can't just sit there, you know, feeling sorry for yourself, so to speak. Things change very quickly in football. So at any point, you could have got a phone call, and the last thing you want to do is get a phone call, need to go and train somewhere, and know, wow, I didn't do the work that was required to be ready as I need to be.
It seems like a lot of different perceptions on what was going on last season after the cup final and then post-lockdown. And you experienced, obviously, you had COVID as well yourself. How do you summarise that season?
I think it's something probably I'm still looking at now, trying to digest, really. Especially, you know, when you go from having, you know, such a good season the season before. There's probably a lot of stuff that, you know, I won't go into now. You know, stuff that probably happened, you know, behind the scenes that didn't help as well. You know, ultimately, as a group, we just didn't perform well enough, you know, week in, week out. So the levels that we could do, it becomes tough down there as well. And I think we'd gathered a lot of momentum just before lockdown. I thought we was in a good, you know, we was in a good place. And I do think not having fans in the stadium, I think, you know, that affected us, you know, negatively. I think we were one of the teams that were thriving off having the fans there, coming to our place, you know, become a real, real tough place. And we thought we could beat anyone. I think we were one of the teams that, you know, really suffered from not having fans there and, like I said, losing that bit of momentum.
How far ahead do you plan now in terms of how long you want to carry on?
It's a question I think I've kind of asked myself quite a few times, but I still feel in really good shape. You know, I'll keep playing as long as I'm enjoying it and as long as I'm fit and healthy to do so. I don't think it's something you can put a number on. I'm very aware that I've been fortunate to, you know, to play for the amount of years that I have. You know, there's, you know, plenty of people who haven't been, you know, fortunate like that. So, you know, try not to look, I suppose, too far in the future, but I try to prepare for it. So, you know, I try to look after myself. Even though I'm vegan, you know, you know, it doesn't mean that you're eating very healthy, but I try to eat healthily. Obviously, I take a lot of advice from Matt on my performance stuff, you know, because, you know, he's an expert in what he does. You know, all those little 1% in my career so far, they've all added up to help me, give me the best possible chance to play for as long as I can, because, you know, that's something I've always had in the back of my mind to play as long as I can. I remember Steve Palmer told me he had a fantastic career, obviously played until he was, I think, 38 years old and tremendous athlete. And he said to me, you know, he regretted not playing one more season because he said, you know, he was physically able to do so and, you know, the hunger was still there, but, you know, he didn't do it. But he always looks back and thinks, oh, you know, I should have done it for an extra year. So for myself, I'll just, you know, keep playing for, you know, as long as I can do.
What emotions are conjured up when you think of your Watford career?
The first moment, I'd say, that was, a big catalyst for me becoming a professional was not getting a scholarship. Yeah, obviously something that at that age can seem quite a negative decision. That gave me real focus at that age just to make it as a professional. And I think I've never really lost sight of that experience from there. I was told I was too small from the age of 14 to play centre-back probably every year. But for different reasons, I didn't get the scholarship at that time. I was on a part-time, same as Ashley Young. It just made me knuckle down. Obviously, I'd seen him go through the same experience a couple of years before and took a lot from what he had done and obviously watched him a lot. And yeah, it just made me really hungry to succeed.
What does this then lead on to, Maps, in terms of, I know you said I'll keep on playing as long as I can. What's next?
I'd love to go into coaching. It's something I've talked about quite openly, you know, and, you know, trying to be a coach and, you know, eventually a manager. You know, even now, you know, I love just helping, you know, like the younger players around me, and I'll always be giving them advice. I love watching players improve. I like just having a positive impact on the environment and the players around me. And I had a lot of, you know, managers, good managers and, you know, not so good managers that I've managed to learn from and pick up stuff from as well. And I mean, I think it's something that, you know, really intrigues me, the coaching game. And I know it's totally different to playing. Yeah, it's definitely something I want to get my teeth into. You know, it's not something I just want to, you know, rush through. You know, I want to, you know, to learn and soak up as much of the information as I can. And, you know, every day, you know, I'm trying to learn whatever the coaches I have. You know, at Bristol now, there's some brilliant coaches there, and I'm always watching the sessions and you know, even just like how other players are responding to, you know, different coaching techniques.
You were talking about your highlights at Watford. I can't remember what game it is, but there's that the slow-mo of you sort of punching in celebration. I don't think you'd even scored, had you?
Chelsea at home when we were 1-0 up, Hazard scored, and then Darian Mat went on that crazy run, and yeah, we beat them 4-1. I remember that game really well. I think we played three at the back, and it was myself and Daryl Yanmat on our side. I remember Hazard he slipped in between both of us, and he shot from about 25 yards, it's gone in. But I had a little pop at Daryl, and then obviously 2 minutes later, he's run through their whole team and scored. And if you're watching the celebrations, he's turning to me to give me a bit back. Well, obviously, I was just buzzing anyway, but yeah, it was brilliant. That was a good night. Good night, the Vic. That.
One quick thing on Javi. I did an interview with him, and he said that when you scored the own goal against Brighton, he got in touch. He was a good guy, wasn't he?
Listen, I can't speak, you know, any more highly of the type of person he is, you know. And, you know, he had messaged me before that, you know, we still keep in contact now. You know, obviously I was disappointed at that. And yeah, he just, you know, gave me a message, you know, get your head up, and you know, which is something I've tried to do anyway. I've had plenty of negative moments in my career that I've had to grow from and learn from. Obviously that's, you know, that was just another one anyway.
Lovely to hear from Adi Mariappa there, and understandably not much about Watford departure. I think that is something for the fullness of time. But there's a couple of lovely little bits we took out of that. One, I think, is mentioning the crowd, and he said that Watford suffered post lockdown with not having the crowd there. And I think in the week that fans are finally heading back to football stadiums, you know, obviously in smaller numbers, I think that's great for us to hear as supporters, isn't it? He made the point that it really, really did make a difference. It does make a difference. They felt better with the crowd behind them at Vicarage Road. And I think as Watford supporters, that's great to hear. I think it's always nice to have that reaffirmed as supporters, that we aren't just sort of howling at the moon, spending our hard-earned money, spending all our time traipsing around the country. It does make a difference. So it was good to hear him mention that. I loved the story about Daryl Yanmat. That was absolutely, absolutely fantastic at Chelsea. With Yanmat having the last laugh dancing through it. But ultimately, I found the whole thing really, really inspiring. You know, a model pro who effectively was, you know, the question about what's one of your most defining or biggest memories about Watford, and it was that initial rejection, wasn't it? And when he mentioned that, everything slotted into place. That, you know, his dedication to fitness, everything. He was just so, you know, he's described as meticulous, I think, wasn't he? And lovely to hear someone just so committed to their trade, which in this case is football. And again, for us as supporters, I think that's quite nice to hear on in a week where we've heard someone who's perhaps made a bad decision. In Adrian Mariappa's case, he's committed his life to making good decisions in terms of being the best footballer he can be, in turn representing the club that he plays for the best he can. And I found his story, you know, you take football out of it, that was an inspirational story. He had a knockback as a youngster and has taken that, and it has fueled him throughout. And you know, I've met him very briefly at various things, and he comes across as a nice guy. The interview, he comes across as a nice guy. So a nice, hardworking footballer who's made a success out of his career and who is always working towards the next thing. Just so lovely to hear.
And Mike, I think, you know, one final thing to sort of draw out of it, aside from the veganism, which is mentioned in the piece, which I have a vested interest in. I have my vegan Ginster corn pasty with me today here at the City Ground, just to let you know. Yeah, really, really, really appetizing, that one. It was the only option in the petrol station, incidentally. Anyway, I digress. But, you know, talking about the fact that strong bond with Watford and Adrian Mariappa, you know, it's mentioned in the piece that there was an apology after not leaving the club in the right way and the club not sort of saying goodbye as they had done with Aurelio Gomez and Jose Holobas. It appears that the dinner that was organised for him in March, which got cancelled due to the pandemic, which was going to be a celebration of his time at the club, there is still plans to have that reorganised down the line. And that's something that the club said, you know, at that time. And I don't think that despite the sort of the silence over his exit, that overall plan has changed. So hopefully in the fullness of time, there will be an opportunity for, you know, Adrian to come back to the club in some form, have this event. And there'll be some closure there, hopefully, once we get back to some sort of normality and events and things like that are possible. So hopefully there'll be a happy ending down the line.
So, Adam, you've written a piece this week with Jack Lang at The Athletic about, well, the future, let's say, Watford star, who's, well, starting to be at least, João Pedro. And it was a fascinating piece that, you know, basically it's The Athletic all over. It's finding out about them, but it's finding out at great depth. And really sort of understanding it. And I read it and I just suppose I didn't know a lot about João Pedro and feel like I know him a little bit better. How do you put an article like that together with such a young player who's from Brazil?
Good question, because when he first arrived and in the build-up to him arriving in January of last year, we were able to do, you know, a certain amount of research into him. But there wasn't really much to talk about. And we weren't necessarily sure how much of an impact he was going to have last season. And it proved that it was only a sort of a small smattering of games that he was going to play. But there was always a tale to be told on, you know, how this boy from Brazil got discovered and then eventually made his way over to England. So, you know, we've been working on it for quite some time, actually. And picking the right time to drop a piece like that is always sort of... It's always an interesting one. Do we run it now? Do we, you know, so we've sort of had it bubbling and sort of preparing it for a couple of weeks. And Jack Lang, who you mentioned there, he is like the hive of knowledge on South American football for The Athletic. And he was able to source a couple of interviews with people that had worked with João Pedro back in Brazil, you know, in his formative years, seen how he developed, some of the sort of the difficulties that he'd had, his transition in different positions as well, his mentality, also the challenges that he'd had in terms of his family background and how Fluminense had looked after him and carefully cared for, you know, on the field in training and things like that, but also externally with his mum as well, who was having some financial difficulties and stuff like that.
Because the article started, Adam, with, well, it blew me away a little bit.
João Pedro's first television appearance came in 2010, when he was only 8 years old. He was considered, even then, to be one of the stars of the Botafogo's academy in Ribeirão Preto, the city of his birth, and destined for big things.
But the main focus of the report was his father, José João de Jesus, more commonly known as Chicão. He was a footballer too, and played for the senior team. The fans loved Chicão, a combative defensive midfielder signed from Inter de Limeira, who gave everything for the shirt. In 2001, he helped his side to the final of the São Paulo State Championship, where they were beaten by Corinthians. The manager of the opponents at the time was Vanderlei Luxemburgo, who was keen to sign Chicão. But it was a move that never materialized, because Chicão's life, and that of his family, was about to change forever. In 2002, he was sentenced to 16 years in prison for being an accessory to murder.
Talked about some of those other moments in his life, Adam. What for you, you know, knowing more about him now, what do you think is the most defining moment he had in developing him as a footballer?
Well, that's a big question. But I think, aside from, you know, obviously you've heard there, you know, he has got footballing genes. His father was a footballer and was a footballer that could have gone on to greater things. And, you know, I almost say it in the piece that the footballing baton was passed on when his father went to prison. And then, you know, he was already being talked about as a great young player at the age of eight. And then when he made that move and he was discovered by Fluminense playing in a tournament not far away from his hometown, and they made the transition and moved to Rio, that was a big change in his life. And then when Fluminense realised that this was a real talent, and his mum, who I mentioned earlier on, was speaking about the financial difficulties that she was facing, and they had to support her and make sure that she was happy, I think that that really helped his development. But then also, and there's a quote in the piece, it centres on the fact that there was an opportunity that arose when a striker was ruled out and João Pedro got given this opportunity, and he grabbed it with both hands. And then he sort of became, in the underage groups in Fluminense, this sort of talismanic figure that was almost sort of older than his years. And there's a moment in a game where they'd gone down, his coach looked over to him, and he could see a spark in his eyes that had basically said, look, I understand the situation, and I'm showing maturity here. And he went on and had a big impact in the game. And then from there, he just went from strength to strength. And the way that he came in to the Fluminense first team, and just, he burst onto the scene. We hear that sort of quite often, but he really, really did. The amount of goals that he scored in that initial period. And yes, okay, it was in a struggling side, and he wasn't able to sort of do that throughout the season. But he was playing men's football very much as a kid, and it was a good schooling. But it's been fascinating to see, you know, even watching a lot of clips of him playing in Brazil, you know, and looking strong and looking, you know, powerful, that even from there, coming over to English football, playing in the Premier League, playing in the Championship, that there has also needed to be a physical transition for him over here. And, you know, lockdown almost served him well because he was able to bulk up. And, you know, we're seeing the sort of rewards of that hard work, I think, now in the Championship, which is such a brutal league. Games coming thick and fast, but also some real sort of cart horse defenders charging after you and flying in with challenges. And he has been, you know, some of the touches, there was just that one touch against Preston. Yes, we saw the goal against Derby, which was fantastic, and, you know, scored his other goals, but it didn't really come to anything. But that touch against Preston on the halfway line, just to pivot away from, I think, about two or three players, dink it over the top of them and then burst forward. You just thought, right, this boy is special. Mm-hmm. And it might take a little bit of time, but Watford have got a great, great player on their hands. And that was shown by the fact that they beat a lot of bigger clubs, the likes of Man City, the likes of Liverpool, to his signature. And that was a sort of a legacy move they'd already done with Richarlison, who he'd watched at Fluminense himself. So it's a really interesting story, and I hope people sort of enjoy the detail that Jack and I were able to go into, because we really enjoyed doing it. You know, you start off doing these pieces and you think, how are we going to piece this all together? But then it comes together and you really enjoy doing it. So, you know, I enjoy doing it, and I'm really enjoying watching him play football at the moment.
That background really is fascinating. I mean, we've spoken about Adrian Mariappa and the sort of slight setback that he had when he wasn't giving a scholarship. And there was a little bit in the piece, Adam, where it mentions that it wasn't quite happening for him when he was quite a little bit younger. He was being moved around position, and there was a moment where the flame went out a little bit, or he didn't see, he wasn't that rising star just for a small period, but he obviously fought his way back. And it's so rewarding to read that, isn't it? When you see someone who has got talent, they've had a bit of a challenge, and they've come back and managed to blaze a career. It slightly sort of feel bad for him when you read about him coming over, and obviously it's Watford Premier League side at the time. Now he's sort of in the Championship, but he does strike me as a player who will take that in his stride. Adam, what really interested me from a Watford point of view as well, sort of jumping forward to the future, and what is quite clear is that the Richarlison example was one that was extremely helpful in terms of getting that deal over the line, so much so that you've got to ask whether that deal would have been done if it wasn't for Watford doing what they did with Richarlison. And you know, there's two things that cross my mind. One, are we going to get to a stage where opposition scouts are scouting Watford scouts to make sure that they get there first? Because, you know, how many times will these teams want to be beaten to the punch? But then as I sort of thought about that in my own head, are actually clubs, let's take Everton as the example, happy for Watford to do the groundwork, happy for them to pay the smaller fee, and then happy for to pay more money further down the line? Or does it suit the bigger clubs for Watford to do that, or are we going to find ourselves getting pipped to the punch? A little, I'm mixing metaphors there, I think, aren't I? Which is not from the rookery end. If I'm not mixing a metaphor, is it? Are bigger clubs not going to put up with being beaten to the punch as often? Which way round do you see it, and does the research you did sort of indicate?
I think that there's two elements to bring into that, and one is obviously the change of rules. Once we leave the EU, is going to have an impact, and bringing in overseas players that are under 18, the complexities of that will only increase. So I think that it's not going to be something that we see a lot of. But Watford do have an advantage, obviously, being able to have players still come in to Europe, to Udinese, for example, and they can sort of house players there. And then maybe once they move above 18, then they can be brought over here. But I think that the important thing to think about, and this sort of touches on another piece that I did a while back about the Pozzo scouting network, that they are very conscious about being quite secretive because they don't want to be seen, and they like the sort of anonymity. And that's why we don't necessarily hear a lot from, you know, the technical director, Filippo Giraldi, for example, because he likes to keep a relatively low profile, especially when, you know, if people don't recognise him when he's going out to games and things like that, then that suits them fine. But I think you're right that, yes, it works both ways. Watford will be able to look at the body of work that they've had via the Pozzos for quite some time to always be able to refer to when they're, you know, offering a pathway to a player. And that involves bringing them to, yes, a smaller club in Italy, Udinese, or Watford in England, and then that stepping stone will be the next big step. So I think it works. I think it works. But there is also, you know, that they will obviously want to try and get there first because they're not going to have to pay as much money. And they pride themselves on their recruitment and their scouting network. So I think it will continue in that form. But you're right that it does, you know, if you keep on having this excellent body of work and bringing in young players like João Pedro or like Richarlison, you're right. People will be going, right, yeah, just check out where Watford are at the moment. But then you have to be covert, don't you? You have to be as covert as you can be and use your connections. It's a business, and you're going to have to be crafty. And that's what Watford have been able to be, and savvy. Probably that's probably the better word, savvy rather than crafty.
Do you think, Adam, it's actually better for the clubs if Watford buy a player like we did João Pedro for 8 million? Because if we then sell him on for 50, they'll then get, let's say, another 10 for sell-on percentages as a round number. That actually is worthwhile them selling players to smaller clubs like Watford that are in the Premier League or around the Premier League so that they will actually get more money in the long run.
Yeah, it's a good point, but I think there is also sort of a risk assessment connected to the whole process as well, because, you know, if you are recruiting younger players, they're not, there's not always guarantees that they are going to be this great success as well. And it's interesting. I did a piece for The Athletic narrating this podcast called Beyond the Headline, and it concentrated on Neymar and his move from Barcelona to Paris Saint-Germain. But it actually talked about his path from Brazil, and he stayed at Santos, where he was playing, for quite a long period. You know, usually young players, and I was thinking about João Pedro and I was thinking about Richarlison, you know, they leave in their late teens. He stayed into his 20s because they thought, now hang on, this is a really, really special player that can win us big titles. And he's also big in Brazil. Player. So, you know, it shows that sometimes these players are let go because, yes, they're big talents, but there's not 100% guarantees that they're going to be to the ilk of Neymar. So you can see the sort of the different route through from Brazil into European football. And the hope will always be that you can end up as big as Neymar. But then there might be a sort of a process where you're Richarlison for a bit and then you improve as you go through the years. So I don't know. It's fascinating. The whole sort of world of recruitment and actually making these deals happen. And let's not forget, for them ending up at Vicarage Road, playing at Watford, is just, it's fantastic. It's balmy, and it just makes for a very exciting time as a fan, and also as a journalist covering it.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Well, luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
Part of the Athletic Podcast Network. This is From the Rookery End.
So, guess what? We've been recording the podcast, and I've got an email. I am going to Vicarage Road on Saturday. I can't believe it. That's amazing.
So, yes. John, are you going to stand in the corner of the Rookery End and the Sir Elton John End after the game and just have a conversation with yourself while you record the podcast live outside the ground? Or would you like us to sort of come to Watford and just look daggers at you and stand there after? No, we won't do that. Wouldn't be allowed to do that.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's very exciting, John. Congratulations.
Amazing. I mean, I really didn't read. I was wanting to go back, but after, as you heard on Saturday's podcast, listening to everybody and their stories about what it means to go back, I am dying to go back there now. I was wanting to go back, but now I'm dying to go back, and I'm lucky enough to have made it through the ballot.
How did that feel, John, opening, getting, seeing that email?
Well, you talking as I got it, and I wanted to go, yeah!
I've got a golden ticket. I've got a golden ticket. I've got a golden ticket.
Well, yeah. That's great. I mean, it's and I talked about, you know, people getting more out of their footballing experience, and straight away, just the return of supporters. You know, Colin's, you know, bouncing from one foot to the other to check his email now to see if he's going. John, you've obviously had that, you know, that moment when it's like, I guess it's like opening your exam results, really, isn't it? You see the email.
That wasn't a good experience, Mike.
No.
And you've got that elation, and there'll be 1,999 other people going through a similar thing now, which is wonderful, and it's fabulous to hear you excited. And I just hope that, you know, more people are going to get more out of their Watford watching experience in the coming weeks and months. And obviously a lot of that will be down onto the pitch, but bit by bit we're getting those little enjoyable elements back into our lives, which is, so congratulations, Sean. I'm thrilled for you.
If you look at what happened to that team up the road that we don't talk about very often, they had 2,000 people in today, and they battered the team top of the table. So maybe the 2,000 fans can really bring something and energise the players in a way that we watched tonight, a rather lacklustre display from both sides. And if maybe 2,000 Forest fans had been in the ground, they would have maybe had a bit more ambition. And I think the same will hold true, hopefully, when we play Cardiff on Saturday. You'll be one of them, John. But I do think people go, well, it's not that many people, it won't make any difference. But I think it will. I think the players must be hungry to have fans, you know, and it's particularly at Vicarage Road, where they're so close to the pitch, just to see faces, to see the passion, the yellow scarves, themselves, the screaming, the shouting at the ref, the pointing at the linesman, all of that just give them an extra, you know, few percentage points of adrenaline, hopefully raise their game, and we'll just see, you know, football with a bit more intensity, because it has been a quite lackluster few weeks, really, football-wise.
You skated over our friends at the M1 there, Colin, quite rightly so. We won't dwell on them too much, but I think it is worth highlighting their game for another reason tonight, which is that the league leaders have lost there. So they've lost 3-1. And we haven't. So the team top of the table has lost away. They've shipped three, and we've come away with a point and a clean sheet. So perhaps that's a little bit of context as well as we take ourselves off to bed.
I don't like that, Mike. Stop
almost
it.
Positive, John. Almost positive.
Well, I haven't been feeling well all day today, so that's a bit of whatever it is.
Oh, so it's the painkillers. Okay, yeah, I hear. I get it. Yeah. Right, cool. Well, thank you very much for your time, Michael, even though you're not 100%.
Not at all. And look, I just think, yeah, let's stick with it. Let's see where it goes. And to everyone who is there on Saturday, have an amazing time. And yeah, I think as we heard from AG Mariappa, the crowd makes a difference. So sing and dance. Well, do what you're allowed to do. Just make the most of it. And congratulations to everyone that's going, and I'm excited about that little bit of normality coming back to our footballing lives. I think it's important.
Thank you very much, Colin.
Oh, hold on. I've just got my email.
Oh, gosh.
Hold on. I'm opening it now. A response to your Cardiff ballot. Oh, hold on. We write to inform you that your ballot application for this weekend's game against Cardiff City has been unsuccessful. So it's just you, John. Have a great time.
Oh, I will. Thank you so much. And look forward to seeing as many of you as possible, even if I don't recognise you behind masks, on Saturday at Vicarage Road, because Cardiff City are visiting and 2,000 Watford fans will be in that stadium for the first time since Watford won 3-0 against Liverpool. We're back after that game for another podcast to see, hey, what's next in this story of Watford season of 2020-2021.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.